Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right, welcome everyone to Value Investing Live. Today, I'm pleased to welcome our guest, David Dietz, founder, president, and chief investment analyst at Point View Wealth Management. Point View Wealth Management is an SEC-registered investment advisor and part of PPAC Private, the wealth management division of PPAC Gladstone Bank, managing over $7 billion, primarily in separately managed accounts. They provide fee-only, independent, customized portfolio management services. The team uses extensive research and sound investing principles to generate superior returns for clients in a way that makes their individual goals and risk tolerances met to the T. As always, for those of you out in the audience, please feel free to post your questions in the chat throughout the presentation, but keep in mind that all questions will be held until we get to the Q&A at the end. Without further ado, I'll go ahead and hand things over to David to jump into the presentation.
Hey, thank you so much, Graham. Well, I want to welcome you to our presentation. We are so excited to have this opportunity to virtually be with you. I'm going to be joined with my esteemed colleague, Fritz Schoenhut. I'm going to give you a little more information on him in a minute. As Graham Griffin just noted, we welcome your questions. We're going to take them at the end. So if you would just log them in where appropriate there in the YouTube channel, we will be sure to answer them. So let's kick this off here. Our topic is value opportunities today. People say, well, you know, who are you? What do you do? Because all information, of course, should be looked at through the lens of where the speaker is coming from. Well, physically, we're here in Summit, New Jersey. We are SEC Registered Investment Advisor. Why is that important? Because that means by law, we have to adhere to the highest fiduciary standards. We are part of PPAC Private. That's a bank here in New Jersey with a huge wealth management arm, which we're part of. We've got over $7 billion under management. So how do we do it? We start with the separate account approach. We review very closely what a family, individual, institution is trying to achieve, customize our advice. And we wrap that in with holistic financial planning. And we're working on behalf of primarily private investors, but also some small institutions. You know, they say it's not what you make, but it's what you make after paying taxes. So therefore, we're always managing for tax efficiency. And as we'll talk about in a second, we're big on using individual securities. So we have the ultimate in terms of transparency. We know what we own. We can see it. We've got a $1 million relationship minimum. Our fee starts at 1%. It does go down with larger amounts under management. And this provides not only the investment management, but also the financial planning. We think it's a bargain because not only do you get advice of us as your advisors, but you also sidestep underlying fees of other products that competitors might actually put your money into. And so therefore you sidestep two sets of fees. We do standalone financial planning. People can retain us for that if they go in that direction and ultimately take the next step to have some of their assets actually managed. The fee they pay is credited dollar for dollar. And of course, it's asset security is always job one. All assets are custody at Fidelity Investments, a leader in brokerage accounts. Next. We've been doing this for over 27 years. Along the way, we have been recognized. CNBC once ranked us actually number 5 in the country in their survey of the top independent fee-only RIAs in the country. Investopedia has also recognized us. And the folks at Financial Advisor Magazine, to name another, also saw fit to name us as one of the top registered investment advisors in 2018. Next. So I am one of your presenters. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we've got Fritz Schoenhut is a colleague of mine here at Point View. He's a portfolio manager. He's a managing director. We're so lucky to have him here because he spent over 5 years at Goldman Sachs, where he held a senior position in the private wealth management division, interfacing directly with some of the ultra high net worth and institutional clients there. That they have. And when you're talking ultra high net worth at Goldman, you're saying something. Of course, before that, he had excellent experience at Grant Thornton in their tax division as a tax associate, working on the tax returns for high net worth individuals and others. He's a Notre Dame guy. Don't hold it against him. Graduated in 2011, bachelor's in finance, and then went on to get his master's of science in taxation. And he is a CFA. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Fritz.
Thank you very much, David. And I appreciate the Notre Dame shout out too. So I will just briefly go over our investment process as well as, you know, a little insight into our equity strategy. So as David mentioned, first and foremost, you know, we manage separate accounts for our clients. And, you know, we really focus on customizing each portfolio to meet the needs of, you know, their individual and family financials. With our clients hand in hand, we develop the appropriate asset allocation utilizing stocks, fixed income, and cash. We tend to steer clear of alternatives and mutual funds and ETFs and focus on the direct holdings of stocks and bonds. On the equity side, which we'll touch on shortly, we like to equally weight our sectors, which allows us to really focus on the investment selection and not making any thematic bets on individual sectors. Additionally, our equity allocation typically has roughly about 35 to 45 individual stocks. We are long only. We do take an all cap approach, so from the small cap to large cap, and based on fundamental bottom up research. We do manage for total return. And as David mentioned, we do manage for tax efficiency. You know, at times, because we have clients that are taxable, have both their, you know, taxable accounts and maybe an IRA or other tax sheltered accounts, we have to put on our tax accountant hats a little bit sometimes. And as David mentioned too, you know, it's about what you, for some clients, it's not so much about what you make, but it's what you make after taxes. So our approach to risk management, as Warren Buffett put it quite simply, you know, there's two rules of investing. One is to not lose money. And number two is don't forget rule number one. And so while, you know, we can't guarantee, you know, you're not going to lose a penny over any period of time, I don't think anyone can make that. What we can do is guarantee that we will take a very intense focus and bring our heavy attention to diversification, which we believe really mitigates risk within the portfolio. An additional way we can reduce risk is we keep individual position sizes relatively small, so nothing more than 3% of the overall portfolio. We do this so that, you know, you're not over allocated or overexposed to one company or ultimately one sector as well. And, you know, the way we view it is, you really, the best way to prepare for the unknown, the best way to prepare is to prepare for the unknown. So this way you're not overreacting when that unknown happens. And now a little bit into our equity strategy. So as I mentioned before, we like to equally weight our sectors, which allows us to really focus on the investment selection. You know, this really helps us focus in on picking the best stocks within each sector for our clients' portfolios. We are more value-oriented managers. We like market leaders. We like the defensible franchise. And as Benjamin Graham said, you buy your stocks like you buy your groceries. You know, we're not looking to pay an arm and a leg for the high growth, high flying tech names. We really like to, for our clients, maximize the earnings, sales, cash flow per dollar of investment outlay. We prefer low debt and a seasoned management that is focused on a strong balance sheet. And while value investing has had a tough go of it over the past decade or so, historically, value has outperformed growth, and that's what we're looking forward to going forward. So with that, I will kick it back over to David.
Hey, thank you so much, Fritz. And Fritz is going to be back with you in a couple minutes with some of his hand-picked investment ideas. Right now, I'm going to just talk a little bit about the market outlook. I mean, this is a real high wire act. I mean, most people, most clients say, you know, we've got increasing COVID cases. No vaccine is directly on the horizon. We have no idea what's going to happen in Washington in terms of a stimulus. We've got over 8% unemployed. Why is this market at all-time highs? And you're right. There's a lot of reasons to be cautious here. I mean, we thought Europe knew how to handle COVID. It became a big political battle here as to how we were handling it. But look, they're having increasing cases there, particularly in some of the big cities, Madrid, London, and Paris. They're starting to restrict activity. Is that coming here? That's definitely a reason to be cautious right now. In terms of the vaccines, we've had, there's over 100 entities across the world that are working on a vaccine. But the fact of the matter is they've got to do the trials. And we had some setbacks in the trials. Certainly, AstraZeneca had a mishap with one of their participants. J&J put their trial on hold. So we don't know when the vaccine's going to come out, which most people agree is the only thing that will allow them to effectively engage in the economy. We're looking at probably here in the United States, Q2 of next year, maybe Q3 in Europe, but there's no certainty there. In terms of the stimulus, basically the latest news here is that Majority Leader McConnell has told really both parties that they're not prepared to do a big bill before the election. I think they're going to be passing a $500 billion bill. That's well short of what the White House and the House of Representatives want to do. So I think there's very little likelihood of seeing something before the election. Most people are hoping that we see something post-election, but there's no guarantee of the amount, exactly what it's going to cover, and the date there. In terms of the election, we thought it looked to be Biden's to lose just a couple of weeks ago. That has tightened now. But I think most people acknowledge it's not just the White House, but also control of the Senate. If the same party controls both the presidency and the Senate, there's a lot more control than if there's a complete flip, let's say a total blue wave. And if that's the case, what does that do to corporate taxes and therefore corporate earnings? What does that do to regulation? These are certainly reasons for near-term caution. Again, with the economy under the COVID blanket here, earnings have been under pressure. As a result, stocks are quite pricey now at about 22 times next year's earnings. That's the highest since, well, two decades ago at the height of the dot-com bubble. And you know what happened after that. So there's extra reasons to be, very cautious as we approach this market. We are now getting results in terms of Q3 earnings. And quite frankly, they've been mixed. In many cases, the actual results have been better than expected, but the guidance is either withdrawn or very, very cautious. Particularly some of the financial stocks have been very cautious as to what the outlook holds. So that's a reason to be a little bit nervous here in the market. And finally, of course, we know the consumer is 70% of the economy, but we have seen continuing very high initial jobless claims, continuing high claims for unemployment, better, admittedly, than April and May, but still historically very high. And that suggests a bit of a slowdown in the recovery. We were carried for a while because of the checks coming out of Washington. Those, as everyone knows, probably ended at the end of July. Right now, there's a big valley here until perhaps the next stimulus package. That is weighing on things. Next page. Okay, so then on the next page, we also show one very interesting feature of this market is how, if you strip out the top six tech stocks, including Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google/Alphabet, and Microsoft, you actually have a market that hasn't done much this year. So that's one reason for optimism, that it's possible to steer clear of some of the very pricey elements in the market and focus on those areas which have not been bid up to astronomical valuations. That's what we're going to try and do for you in a minute. Next. So here's the bullish case here. You know, the fact of the matter is, each day we get closer to some of the big headwinds, resolving some of the big headwinds in the market. What do I mean by that? Well, the election now is less than 2 weeks away. Hopefully we have a decision and we wake up the next day. But ultimately, even if it was the year 2000, it's a prototype, we will have a decision before long. So that uncertainty will be behind us. Vaccines. With 100 entities around the globe working as hard as they can, we're going to see something sooner rather than later. And remember, it's almost like a 1960 style space race. Every country is working on it so they can take the mantle for the very first vaccines. That's the reason for optimism. As we just mentioned, as we just focused on the prior slide, if you strip out big tech, valuations are much more reasonable. And of course, at the end of the day, T-ness still prevails. There is no alternative with interest rates pinned down and look to be pinned down by the Federal Reserve for years now. That makes stocks the natural alternative. And then finally, we're going to see, I think, big fiscal spending with the next bill. But I think we can also see it worldwide. Even the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is endorsing governments around the world, instead of being frugal, to go big and spend money to jumpstart economies. And that's quite different from the approach that many countries, including our own, took a decade ago during the subprime crisis. Next. So we've got some picks for you. We've got basically seven picks in different sectors. Notice that the chart on the right shows asset class returns. And the point of that little chart there is that each year, a different subset of the equity world takes the mantle in terms of the best return. So, you know, what's the point? The takeaway is to be diversified, because it's not the same group each time. It's hard to pick out in any given year what will be the leading group. Do stay diversified. We're going to try and do that for you. Next. So we're going to start right in the most pain trade possible, the energy sector. And you can see here from the chart, going back the last decade, the orange line is the S&P 500. And starting in about 2014, the blue shaded area, which is energy stocks, was keeping up. And then ever since then, it's been a disaster for energy investors. But, you know, as they say in the business, particularly energy, the best cure for low prices is, well, low prices. And back then, price per barrel of oil was over $100. Now it's about 40. And so what do people do when the price is that low? They stop exploring. They stop drilling. They stop investing. The banks cut them off and supply starts to dwindle. And pretty soon, we believe, ultimately, the prices will start coming back up. Of course, green initiatives are weighing on it. But the fact of the matter is, people come up to me and say, you know, we're not going to be using fossil fuels forever. And I say, you're right. But guess what? We're going to be heating our houses with natural gas longer than you're going to be using your iPhone. It's going to take a long period of time. Price to book is down about 1.1, which is the cheapest for the overall sector since 1986. And of course, sentiment is ugly. It reminds me, guys, a lot of Philip Morris in the year 2000, when everyone said, why would you invest in a tobacco company when you know everyone's stopping smoking? In the next decade, Philip Morris, of all 500 stocks in the S&P 500, was the number one performer. So sometimes ugly sentiment can be an investor's friend. Next. So why are we optimistic? Okay, mergers are picking up, and that's going to be able to cut costs. We're seeing Chevron picking up Noble, Devon, and WPX. Conoco on Monday just announced a tie-up with Concho. And just yesterday, Parsley and Pioneer are tying up. That will allow them to become more efficient, reduce waste, and ultimately that will benefit shareholders. Again, we talked about how with the low prices, companies are just slashing their exploration development budgets. It's gone down from $100 billion a year in the United States to just $45 billion. Rig count is down by about two-thirds in the last year, dropped by 569 to just 282 now. You know, and there's a totally different mindset. Back in 2014, when things were going well, it was like, how fast can we get big? And now the focus is how fast can we get lean and start sharing some of the revenues with the shareholders? The shareholders want a return on their money. So that's a change in the mindset. And of course, we've got the COVID. So every day we get closer to a vaccine, every day we're going to get closer to normalizing energy use. Indeed, this past August, there's 12% less miles driven in this country. Even though no one wants to get on a plane or go overseas, they want to drive. They're still driving double-digit percentage less this past summer than they were the prior summer. That will change. So our pick next, Exxon. Go with the biggest. And why would we do that? Well, first of all, it's the commodity business that's hard to add value. But Exxon, as an integrated energy operation, is in all the different spaces of the energy business. That would be the upstream business, which would include exploring and extracting fossil fuels, including gas oil. But they're also involved in the transportation of it. That's the so-called midstream. They own pipelines and so forth that gets it from the fields to, you've got to refine it so it can be used in automobiles, so it can be used by jet planes and so forth. They're actually, believe it or not, the world's biggest refining operation. And then, of course, they also have chemical operations, which, believe it or not, actually benefits from lower energy prices because energy is an input, and if that's lower and they can maintain the same price as the outputs like plastics, their profit spreads go up. So Exxon, notwithstanding the lower prices and green initiatives, have actually doubled down on energy exploration. Some of the companies have said, gee, you know, we'll try and adapt to the new world and shifting investments into green initiatives, not Exxon. Exxon is doubling down and say, we know over the next decade or so, we're going to need more energy. We're going to have to increase our budget to find it. And that's what they're doing. And actually, investors have punished them for it. And you can see the last 7 years. 7 years ago, Exxon was the Apple. Exxon was the biggest company on the planet by market cap. Now it suffered the ignominy of being kicked out of the Dow. And you can see the huge loss of market cap. Next. So, you know, one thing that's instructive is just recently, Exxon's market cap has slipped below Chevron's. And you can see the chart there, which shows year to date the path between the black line, Exxon, and Chevron, and how Chevron's outperformed. But, you know, it's all about fundamentals. For us here at Point View. And although Chevron has a larger market cap, Exxon has 40% more book value. And if you, as Fritz told us earlier, act like Ben Graham and look for the most book value for your investment dollar, that's Exxon. Exxon also has twice the proven reserves than Chevron. So again, if you're looking for most proven reserves for your dollar investment outlay, go with Exxon. Exxon's got the bigger dividend, 10% versus Chevron at 7%. Now, a lot of people say, but Exxon's not covering their dividend. And you're right. I actually think if they were to slash the dividend, the stock would go up 10% before you finish your cup of coffee, because people would take a sigh of relief that they're not going to borrow to cover that dividend. You know, both Exxon and Chevron are dividend aristocrats. Everyone likes dividends, but even better is companies that regularly increase that dividend. You don't become a dividend aristocrat unless you've increased that dividend each year for the last 20. So Exxon takes seriously that dividend and returning money to shareholders. That's good. They are out of favor since they're kicked out of the Dow, but who cares from an investment perspective? We're looking at fundamentals, not whether they're one of the 30 Dow companies. Finally, I think that there's an outside chance that Chevron and Exxon merge together. I'm not holding my breath, but remember, at one point, they were all part of Standard Oil about 100 years ago. If that were to happen, there could be some tremendous cost cutting. If they change their name, that would help them. If they cut the dividend, that would help them. And maybe to placate environmental concerns, if they were to announce some green initiatives, I think the stock would also go up too. So we're suggesting Exxon as part of people's diversified portfolios. Next. Financials, out of favor, low interest rates. The most important product they have for the people is what they charge for mortgages and loans. With interest rates so low, they're getting less for that. Weak economic activity due to the COVID, of course. people are doing, taking out less loans, that hurts on them. And of course, there's uncertainty as to whether they're going to be paid back for the loans already extended. That has hurt them. But as a result, valuations are quite attractive. You can see here year to date where the orange line is the S&P 500. The blue line is the regional bank index, how it's really come undone. I mean, you could make a lot of money if a vaccine is announced that just goes back up to where it was in February. You can see that. Certainly, financials came into this pandemic in better shape than they were in 2008. They have basically been successful takers of the stress tests imposed on them by the Federal Reserve. And of course, there's this value versus growth debate. Eventually, historically, value comes back. Financials are the largest sector in the S&P 500. So if value is going to come back into play, financials must participate. Next. But it's not going to be quick. They may have to cut dividends if earnings don't pick up because now they're required to have earnings cover all dividend. We don't know how long the pandemic lasts. Loan defaults could rise, but of course, they've done a lot of provisioning, so perhaps already anticipated. We don't know when interest rates will finally go up. Most people are taking the Federal Reserve warning that interest rates are going to stay lower for longer at face value, and that's going to be a headwind. And of course, the Fed might decide to try and knock down not just short interest rates, but longer term interest rates, a technique called yield curve targeting, which would reduce the spread that they can make between what they pay on depositors and what they can charge borrowers. Recent earnings by some of the big banks have been seen as half empty, although they generally have beat expectations. It's been through trading profits and less bad loan provisioning. But they are still cautious as to the outlook and not sure that they're not going to have to increase bad loan provisioning. So their earnings announcements have been seen as half empty. But there's some upside. As Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan just pointed out, they may have over-reserved for bad loans. And JP Morgan says they may be over-reserved by about $10 billion. We're seeing some M&A activity there. For example, First Citizens and CIT just got together. Next. Our pick here is Wells Fargo. It was a Buffett favorite. It's no longer a Buffett favorite, although he still owns 3.3%. But we like the fundamentals. We like the fact that they're focused in the United States and not overseas makes it a little less risky. We like the fact that they're not involved in trading, which is a very cyclical type activity. They've got that middle market focus. They're one of the largest credit card issuers. They've got the three key divisions. They've got the middle market lending. They've got the wealth management. They've also got this consumer division. So it's a simpler bank to understand. They're one of the top deposit gatherers in the nation. Why is that important? Because that's manna from heaven when people give you money for the FDIC insurance, because that's not hot money. That's going to stay with you. They've got the economies of scale. Financial services undergoing a revolution, just like all other sectors of the economy, making everything mobile, virtual. That's taking a lot of big investments in terms of tech. Wells Fargo can afford it. They've got that loyal customer base and they can have the cross-selling opportunities. Next. So what's it going to take to get Wells Fargo to get off its 52-week low? Well, one big headwind is that because of the fake account scandal of a couple of years ago, the Federal Reserve has put a cap on the amount of assets that they can hold at $2 trillion. They need to convince the Fed to lift that cap. If they do that, Wells Fargo is going to be a big winner. Charlie Scharf has just taken over management he came from Bank of New York. He's the new CEO. He's still getting his sea legs there. And so we're waiting to see how that works out. Valuation, though, is attractive. If they were to liquidate the bank, you'd get $32 a share. That's the so-called tangible book value. Right now, it's at $22 a share. That's one of the best valuation discrepancies you're going to find in a lifetime in terms of a major bank like Wells Fargo. Historically, it trades at a 40% premium to tangible book value. So you can have a double if it goes back to where it was normally. And of course, they have no choice but to cut costs. That's the nice thing about having a new man in the CEO C-suite, because he has less loyalty to the people that he's going to have to show pink slips to. They've talked about cutting costs. They've been reticent to give details. We think that as soon as the election is passed, so they're not embarrassing anyone out there, they're going to make the big announcements. And so that could be a catalyst for Wells Fargo to move ahead. Next. REITs, another one of our favorite areas here. This chart here shows you that over, you know, the long term, over the last 25 years, REITs, as reflected in the blue, have actually outperformed on a total return basis the S&P 500. Their dividends are typically twice what the markets are. They don't have to pay corporate taxes. They're a pass-through entity. That could be critical if there's changes following the election in the amount of the corporate tax rate, because it won't affect REITs since they don't have to pay taxes. That could make them look even more attractive. Their net asset values are less than typically private market values, what people would pay in private transactions for the same properties. And if ultimately all this deficit spending and money creation leads us to inflation, with as investors in real assets like real estate, they could be and historically have been a good inflation hedge. Next. So this year, it has not been a good year for REITs. And you can see REITs is reflecting the blue, big underperformers year to date to the orange S&P 500. Other than e-commerce storage space, everyone is skeptical of REITs. They're saying, we'll never go back to the office to work. It'll all be done remotely. We'll never go back to big cities to live. Everyone will be living out in the country. People are saying, well, I thought government said I didn't have to pay my rent if there was a COVID issue. So now people as investors are saying, well, why would I invest in a category where the government's saying people don't have to pay the bills to the securities I might invest in? So that's been a big depressant, but we think that normalcy will eventually return, and there's enough of a discrepancy here that you can make some good money. So what's our pick to participate in REITs coming back? Next, equity residential. So we're not investing in office space or strip malls. We're in plain Jane apartments. And this company owns 300 apartment communities across the country, over 78,000 units. We think that no matter what happens, what the long-term effects of COVID-19 are, people are still going to need a roof over their head. They're also able to add increased profits by a roll-up strategy where they add apartment buildings to their portfolio. We think that with this near 5% dividend that EQR boasts, an estimated $71 share net asset value versus the current $50 quote, there's money to be made here. Remember, this is the company that was started by the legendary Sam Zell. Next. What else do we have for you? We think utilities on the West Coast offer an opportunity. Now, everyone is spooked about what's going on out there between the protests in Portland and the wildfires in California and up and down the coast. We think people would just as soon turn their back on that area of the country. But also the bankruptcy of Pacific Gas Electric has also scared people off. But the fact of the matter is, all those states out there, particularly California, if they're serious about wanting only electricity-driven cars over the next decade, they need to support that industry. And you can see year to date, the underperformance of companies like Edison International and Portland General and Sempra, which is the owner of San Diego Gas and Electric, how poorly they have done. So they're down. Next. Our pick here is Edison International. They're the monopoly electricity supplier for most of Southern California, other than the actual city of LA. You know, what we like about utilities and what Warren Buffett likes about them is they basically have no competition. There's only, if you want to buy electricity for your home, there's usually only one service provider. They've done a great job over time. They've doubled their dividend since 2013, and they're targeting a payout of nearly half of all their profits to share with stockholders. The stock is well off of its high here at about $59 a share versus a 52-week high of nearly 80. And we think that with a 12 PE versus the market at 20, there's too much pessimism factored into that valuation. And again, we think that ultimately the creation of a $21 billion state fund that was started to help people that suffer from wildfires in connection with the PCG, the Pacific Gas and Electric litigation, will also benefit Edison International and take some of the risk off of their company and therefore their stock. Next. At this point, I want to turn it back over to Fritz to take you home here.
Thank you, David. Yes, I'm going to go through a couple more picks here. The first is Anheuser-Busch InBev, BUD. So Anheuser-Busch is the largest beer brewer in the world and operates in a very competitive industry. But as you can see, over the past 5 years, and really starting back into 2016, Anheuser-Busch is down about 50% versus an S&P 500 that is doubled in that same time. And so, you know, when we're looking at the company here, you know, what's really been driving this, you know, these headwinds, and the first being just a result of the high debt level taken on during its acquisition of Saab Miller in 2016, as well as a strengthening U.S. dollar. Anheuser-Busch generates a little over 75% of its revenues overseas, so a stronger U.S. dollar puts more strain on those international revenues. Here on this page, we've got some metrics, and I'll pick out a few. So, when we're seeing the dividend yield, we like the dividend yield. It's been a consistent payer over time. Current yield is about 2.6%. They recently cut it this year, just during the COVID pandemic, but we still like the above average dividend yield. The stock is down about a little over 30%. Year to date. So, you know, hasn't kept up with the broader market, but as we pointed out, there's a lot of opportunities out there for stocks that are still underwater. The expected earnings are, going to be a little more difficult this year, analysts expect, but going forward, you know, we do anticipate seeing a rebound. And then lastly, on the balance sheet, the net debt of a little bit over $95 billion. You know, this is a large figure. It's definitely a cause for concern, but, we like to focus on what management has said and then doing around that. And so I'll get into that shortly. So, you know, when we consider Anheuser-Busch, you know, what is the opportunity? What do we like about the company? And so, you know, first off, we think that size is strength in this industry. Anheuser-Busch has over 100 different brands, 18 of which generate over $1 billion in revenue. And some of these global brands include very well-known beers, including Budweiser, Corona, and Stella. And given the size of the company, it's no shocker that, you know, their pricing power is pretty robust, illustrated by a 59% gross profit margins. And we also like the company because, you know, as we mentioned before, you know, we like market leaders, and we feel that, you know, Anheuser-Busch, as the largest beer brewer, is exactly that. It's a market share leader and or holds a monopoly in various markets around the world, including the US, Belgium, Ukraine, and parts of Africa. And so when we look at a more mature company in a very competitive industry, you know, what are the opportunities going forward? And we've seen over the past couple of years a changing in consumer tastes and preferences for ultimately what they're drinking. And we've seen this rise of the craft beer movement started maybe about 5 years ago to the hard seltzers that have really taken off in the past year and a half. And to that, you know, we've seen the Budweiser brand come out with their hard seltzers. Corona's come out with their hard seltzers. And so we're encouraged to see, you know, they are keeping up with the times there. And on the craft brew side, just last year, they acquired Craft Brew Alliance for about $220 million. And so they've shown that they can be a skilled acquirer, and we do expect more in an industry with the consolidation that's expected. On to management, they've definitely shown a willingness to really focus on paying down their debt, deleveraging their balance sheet. We did see a dividend cut earlier in the year that took a hit on the stock price. But ultimately, they're consistent in paying down the debt is a management that a management style that we like to see. Anheuser-Busch also owns 62% of AmBev, which is another international beer brewer, and they hold monopoly and/or they are the market leader in many Latin America countries and Canada as well. And certainly, when we look at the chart and we look at the brand itself, strong brand name, COVID has had an impact, and the stock is down roughly 30%. But if we can get up to February, the pre-COVID February highs, that represents nearly a 50%. Increase in stock price and one that we think is certainly achievable. CVS Health Corp. So as we can see from the chart, CVS has really been struggling to keep up with the broader market, down roughly about 40% over the past 5 years. We see that this is centered around a couple different factors. One, of course, it's the headwinds of the political debate surrounding healthcare reform and health insurance reform. Their purchase of Aetna, while we think it's long-term a good move, it certainly thrust them into the middle of that debate and the issues surrounding that. But then additionally, the rise of e-commerce. So not just, Amazon, the ability to get anything you need, but the now e-pharmacies that are popping up. We see commercials for them. So those are headwinds that CVS is facing. And while the healthcare side, there may be some clarity, which I think ultimately we all want to see over the next couple of weeks, even months, and couple of years. The rise of these internet players is certainly one to focus on as well. So a couple of quick facts on CVS here. Again, a strong dividend at 3.36%. They're down about 20% year to date, and with consistent earnings per share, they are trading pretty attractively relative to the broader market at 7.9 times 2021 earnings. And they do have another company here with a decent amount of debt on the balance sheet from the Aetna acquisition. But one that management also has taken a pretty consistent focus and plan of attack around on paying down. So ultimately, what is the opportunity when we think, 3 to 5 years out on CVS? And first, one thing that's really attractive is, the growth and their promotion of these health hubs and minute clinics. So, you can walk into your CVS pharmacy at the local strip mall or shopping center. And the plan is they're going to be rolling out these minute clinics and health hubs where you can go in. Your child can get tested for strep throat. You can see someone about, an ear infection. And this industry, this healthcare services industry, is growing roughly about 5 to 9% annually. So, we see it as a very organic addition to the CVS pharmacy model. You can go somewhere and not just pick up your prescriptions, but you can go and see a doctor, see a nurse, and potentially, get those prescriptions in the first place. We also see a big opportunity around the COVID vaccine. So, there is this expected COVID vaccine over the course of, the next year, let's say. And CVS has pointed to earlier this week that they're planning to hire 15,000 employees to help with that rollout. And so when we think of what they're planning on doing with the health hubs and minute clinics and what we've been seeing with COVID testing, at CVS, with the eventual administration of the vaccine, I think there's an opportunity to really show consumers that they can do more than just be the place to pick up your prescription. And then ultimately that also flows into the third idea, which is growth begets growth. And so, as you get more people into CVS, the retail side of the business will also improve and increase. So ultimately, we feel that the Aetna headwinds are beginning to abate, and there's certainly opportunities that are starting to rise up. So with the Aetna headwinds, there was a large amount of debt on the balance sheet, but with management's focus on paying that down, we think there's still a lot of opportunities for the efficiencies and synergies and ways that they can really work together. Secondly, as they pay down the debt, And as Aetna becomes more of a, part of ingrained within the CVS culture, we think that there's an ability for, your CVS store, the 10,000 plus of them around the country, to really be the one-stop shop for all of the needs of their customers, from the insurance to seeing a doctor to picking up your prescription and grabbing a carton of milk on your way out. So the third one here and last is Disney. So Disney certainly hasn't had as rough a go of it as the previous two two picks over the past 5 years. It is positive, but only 24%, and still well underperforming the broader market. And as anyone paying attention to the market and the pundits out there, a lot of focus even currently this week on the parks and resorts and when they'll be able to open and the rules around all of that around COVID. And considering that the parks and resorts account for roughly 30% of Disney's revenues, certainly it had an impact on the stock price, as we've seen. Now, the stock has climbed back about 50% since then, but there's still a lot of uncertainty about where we're headed in terms of the vaccine and allowing people back to amusement parks, what that, how many people can go. So there's additional pressure still on the stock itself. So a couple of quick bullet points to point out. They did cut their dividend earlier this year, so it's currently at zero. They are down about 12% year to date. And their earnings are not looking too great for this year at under $1.50. But the expectation is a solid rebound in 2021 and the years to come. They have not as much debt on the balance sheet, so they have a pretty cleaner balance sheet. And their free cash flow yield, although it's low right now, over a five-year period, it averages about 4.3%. So what do we see in Disney? What is the opportunity that's there? When we first look at the parks and resorts longer term, as long-term investors, our base case is a return to normalcy. As eventually we'll get a vaccine, eventually people return to the parks, return to the resorts, the cruise ships, the hotels, everything that's really helped make Disney the place that it is today. But also additionally, Disney Plus is a real game changer and has really shown what it can do for the company since its successful launch last October and November. It's really an immediate competitor to Netflix, Amazon Prime, Apple TV, because it basically was just needed a platform for this huge library of Disney classics that so many generations have grown up watching and falling in love with. And ultimately, this also acts as a hedge for the current environment in this direct-to-consumer world. And potentially, the new CEO stepping in has indicated that this could be a longer-term option, giving them more, pricing power, really, in terms of how they go about charging for the different levels of service within the app itself. Disney, take a step back. It's a really solid company, great brand, steeped in creativity and innovation. So this is a company that we typically would like to see in our portfolios. And it's not only that they have this long, rich history of creating content that viewers love, but it's consumers as well. And so, as long as they can continue to put out new movies, new TV shows, and put them in a platform and in a service that viewers will continue to enjoy, we think that also adds to the, on the consumer side, new toys, new park rides, new hotels, new characters. So there's plenty of ways for Disney to really take advantage of their brand, and they're just building out around it. And when we look at it compared to Netflix, for example, very similar market cap. And while Netflix is the must-have streaming platform, Disney has the library and, like I said, has the track record to create this top content and then ultimately offer multiple sources of revenue once they've put that movie or put that TV out there. So with that, we'll move it over to questions, David.
Great. I'm going right back to you here with a question. Someone asked us, quote, sorry, how is the fee reduced if the client chooses to do investments with you if they were a financial planning only client?
I'm not sure I really understand that question, how the fees are reduced.
So I think what they mean is we charge people a flat fee to do a comprehensive financial plan. We look at their investments. We look at their retirement saving strategies, everything from a financial perspective under the sun. They pay us the fee. Then they say, please manage some or all of my money. How does that work then?
Yep. Yeah. And then so that flat fee gets credited directly to what is ultimately the management fee on an ongoing basis. So that flat fee year one gets credited towards whatever you would pay on an ongoing basis for the investment management piece.
Great. So we've got another question. I'm going to give it right to you, Fritz. Values underperform for over a decade. What is it going to take to turn it around?
Yeah. No, it's been a difficult 10, 11, 12 years for sure. And, you know, we've seen some encouraging signs even as just recently as September of this rotation from growth into value. And I think in order to see a more sustained outperformance, we expect to see a continuation of, you know, the economic reopening and stabilization. We like to see some more growth in the manufacturing. And, you know, as David alluded to, or actually mentioned earlier in the presentation, with financials being such a big part of the value sphere, we'd like to see, you know, a backup in interest rates as well. I think, you know, that would help the financials. That would also, you know, typically those are a headwinds to stocks, but, you know, you've got so many, you know, growth companies that aren't projected to have earnings until well out in the future. With higher rates, higher interest rates, those get discounted a bit more. And I think you'd see more more interest in the companies that are currently producing returns, currently you know, experiencing cash flows and paying those back to investors. And so, you know, we'd like to see, you know, the three things: the economic reopening and stabilization, a growth in manufacturing, and a backup in interest rates.
Thanks, Fritz. So we've got a question here that I'm going to field, which is, are you pressured by your clients to invest in overvalued stock, such as some tech companies, when they become even more overvalued? And, you know, I think there's two aspects to that. One is you have to know yourself as an investor. We have to know what we think is going to work. And how do we do that? Well, basically, I think it's a combination of being market historians and then, of course, having been investors for over 25 years, you develop the sense as to what is ultimately not going to work and what will work. We lived through the dot-com implosion. We lived through the subprime crisis. So as I think Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger and people like that said, if you know who you are as an investor, the market can be an expensive place to find out. So first, you have to have that inner sense of what makes sense. Then the question is, it's an education thing. You need to communicate it to the client. Now, certainly, the easy thing, of course, is to say, well, if that's what you want to do, fine. You know, that's like if you're a bartender and the person's staggering in and said, I want my 11th drink. And you're saying, well, it's easier to give it to them than to cut them off. The responsible thing to do is to explain patiently the history as you understand it, why other areas of the portfolio are working, what the risks are, what the dividend yield might be on some of those overvalued stocks, and ultimately convince him or her of why not chasing what has gone up and not panicking when something goes down ultimately is the way to create real wealth. So I think it's just an educational process after you figure out what you should be doing yourself. So we've got another one for you, and I'm going to give it to you, Fritz, which would basically be, what are your thoughts on inflation and how does that impact stocks?
Yeah, certainly. So Inflation expectations really impact how the Fed determines their rate policy, which in turn affects everything from the interest rates on bonds to, as I mentioned before, how we discount the future earnings of companies to come up with a fair value. So the Fed has tried for years to push inflation or lift inflation up, but it's shown to be quite stubborn, and so much so that now, in our view, the risk is that people might be underestimating the potential for an inflation surprise. The Fed's come out and said, they're expecting to keep rates lower for longer. They've expanded the band of which, they would allow inflation to run. But if we do see a pop-up of inflation, we've had just tremendous amounts of money flow into the economy. If we do see an inflation surprise, there's nothing holding the Fed to, their previous conversations or the previous, comments about their interest rate policies. So if there is this surprise inflation, the Fed may have to take action sooner than expected by raising rates. Now, while this usually means that the economy is running well and doing better, it is typically a headwind for stocks. We are always vigilant and cautious on inflation. Like we said, we take a very equally weighted approach to our portfolios to minimize risk. But inflation is one that's been low for so long. We have to be cautious in terms of the potential for any surprises there.
Thank you, Fritz. So I'm going to pick up on this next one, which is a great question. Thoughts on why Warren Buffett seems to be favoring Bank of America over Wells Fargo? This person writes, is it image related? Does he dislike the management? Is there a risk that management might change the fundamentals of the business? And it is a great question. We love Bank of America, too. I like Brian Moynihan. I do feel that they may have a few more options there because, of course, they acquired Merrill Lynch in the depths of the last crisis. And I suppose they could spin it out. And that might be a way to unlock value. So nothing against Bank of America. But, here's the thing. Let's take the page from Benjamin Graham. Bank of America trades at 20% over tangible book value, while Wells Fargo trades at about a 40% discount to book value. Now, if book value is book value, and both banks are across the country dealing with everyday businesses and so forth, why would I want to pay a 20% premium for something that I could get at 40% off? I think if you dig deep down, Warren Buffett would agree with you on that. I do think there's an image problem. And I think that Warren Buffett has steered clear of industries like guns, like tobacco, that could be linked and somehow hurt his image and ultimately the valuation of Berkshire Hathaway. So I think that's something important. It is true. Warren Buffett warned the management of Wells Fargo, don't get another New York money center banker as your new CEO. And not only did they do that, but one thing that is not great is that the head of Wells Fargo, which is now headquartered in San Francisco, Charlie Scharf, has maintained his New York residence. Although I suppose in today's remote virtual working world, doesn't really matter where you are, but that's not a positive. Having said that, that wouldn't be enough for me to pay a 20% premium for something that I could get 40% off. So I think there's more similarities and differences, but the valuation to us tips the favor. Also keep in mind, Warren Buffett has been selling bank stocks across the board. He's been selling US Bank Corp. He's been selling JP Morgan. Obviously, he's got some other great lieutenants working with him. He may not be the only one making the decision. I've been out to Omaha. I love Warren Buffett, but I still got to call him for me and my clients the way I see him. And we still like Wells Fargo here. Fritz, how about this one? Why don't you use exchange traded funds?
Sure. So you know, we like to hold the direct holdings of stocks and bonds. ETFs, what we've found is one, you know, first off, we like to minimize costs for our clients. And so, you know, in that regard, you know, we'd like to, one way to do that is to not hold these funds and not pay the additional fees that you'd be paying to the fund itself. Secondly, from a diversification standpoint, you know, these ETFs or other mutual funds could hold hundreds of different stocks. And so, you know, from a diversification standpoint, we believe that that's a bit over diversified. So we could really tailor and custom build a portfolio for each client, utilizing the 35 to 45 stocks. Another factor is the potential for overlapping. If you hold multiple ETFs, you know, you might hold, you know, Apple in one and Apple in another, and you're not really sure what your allocation to Apple is. And so this way, you know, clients really know what they hold and how much of it that they're holding. And along those same lines, when you hold multiple ETFs or mutual funds, one manager may be selling, one manager may be buying. There's not much focus involved. And it's also, you know, a more of a headache from a tax perspective. So, you know, holding the direct holdings, we know exactly what you're holding. We know how much, we know, you know, how we can tweak and tilt the portfolio one way or another. And then from a tax perspective, you know, we're never buying and selling the same stocks in the same days. So we feel that there's a lot of advantages, let alone cost advantages and tax advantages, to holding the direct holdings versus ETFs.
Hey, thanks, Fritz. So we've got a good question here from Asad Laif. How do you explain the fact that the growth in stock market prices is higher than pre-COVID days? COVID-19 has been good for the stock market, even though the real economy is devastated. That's a great question. First of all, I would take issue with the fact that the stock market is doing that great as a result of COVID-19. We showed you that one slide that if you strip out the top six tech stocks, it's a whole different picture. And indeed, according to Morningstar, if you look at the equally weighted S&P 500, you're down year to date by about 2%. If you look at the Russell 2000, which is a great barometer of small stocks, which historically over the long haul have outperformed their bigger brethren, that's down year to date. If you look at the international index, it's down about 5%. So I would argue that there hasn't been much growth. But one reason why you can justify the higher stock prices is the interest rates. You started the year, interest rates are now about a third of where they were at the start of the year. And every day people are saying, well, what is the yield on the 10-year treasury? What's the yield on the market? It's very rare for the yield on the market to be greater than the yield on the 10-year treasury. Right now, it's almost double what it is on the 10-year treasury. So you might argue that, you know, why are interest rates so low? They've been engineered by the Federal Reserve to be down, and so stocks have just kind of followed up. The other thing is, of course, you know, the tragedy in terms of the economy as well as the health situation of Americans due to COVID-19 is very bad. But you still have to remember 92% of the people do have jobs and are working. And fortunately, each recession is different. This is a blue-collar recession. We've seen a lot of recessions like after the dot-com implosion where it was a white-collar recession. As a result, those consumers who tend to spend less are the ones that are under the most pressure, while those who have the white-collar jobs who can work remotely, they're still hanging in there. That's another reason why the market is doing well. Remember, the market is a market cap weighted market in terms of the S&P 500. So it's measuring the performance of the largest stocks. Obviously, to the extent you're just measuring the performance of Main Street America, it is a tragedy. But that's not what the market is all about as measured by many of these indexes. Thank you. Fritz, do you see the questions there? Is there one that you want to pick out and handle?
I do not see the questions.
Okay. I think we have time for one more question. And I think that they want to follow up on your Anheuser-Busch pick. And someone quibbles. They say the PE is at 96 on Budweiser. That is not what Fidelity.com is showing. They show them earning over $4 in the last 12 months. And also, of course, they own a lot of key subsidiaries like the the ABEV and AMBEV, which controls all of Latin America and basically keep their earnings within them. So they're just getting a small dividend coming out of it, which also affects the valuation. Do you want to weigh in here a little bit on Budweiser's valuation, Fritz?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, looking at it, I think some of the valuation is struggling from, you know, the reduced earnings expected for this year. And, you know, if they are not receiving those additional earnings from subsidiaries, then, you know, that would affect the PE. You know, but we still see the potential value in Anheuser-Busch here. And I think it might just be an issue with maybe the data there on that PE.
Good. And we've got time for one more question. And Fritz, you're on a roll here. Is there one sector that you think could be of value to investors no matter who wins the election?
Yeah, certainly. You know, when we think about, you know, potential outcomes and what maybe both sides of the aisle can agree on, you know, industrials definitely stand out. I think most people agree, a lot of analysts agree that, you know, there was some disappointment given all the stimulus that we've seen this year, that there wasn't any really earmarked for any infrastructure spending. And so I think there's, you know, as we've seen, both sides of the aisle agree that there is broad support for an infrastructure deal, some infrastructure spending. You know, we look around our country, there's certainly a need for that and to upgrade a lot of the bridges, tunnels, railroads, highways. And so, you know, in our view, regardless of the outcome, we would expect, you know, the industrial sector to do quite well, assuming that there will be, you know, the broad support for and eventually some sort of stimulus plan or fiscal spending on infrastructure.
Great. Thank you so much, Fritz. I want to thank everyone out there for watching us today. Many more questions than we can possibly answer. You do have our contact information. We would love to consult with you individually if the spirit moves you. Again, thank you. I'm going to hand off to our wonderful sponsor, Guru Focus, and Graham to give his final parting remarks.
Awesome. Well, thank you, David, and thank you, Fritz, for joining us today and for giving that wonderful presentation and for taking the time to answer all these questions. I know our audience really does appreciate it. Moving on into the future, we hope that all of you in the audience enjoyed what you saw. If you missed any of it, there will be a full recording posted here on YouTube as well as on Guru Focus. So please feel free to go ahead and go check that out. You can look back through the slides and things like that. If you did enjoy, we'd really appreciate it if you gave the video a like and go ahead and subscribe to the channel if you haven't. If you turn on those notifications, you'll be alerted every single time that we upload a new video so you can keep track of all of our content. As far as things go, we hope to see you next week with our next Value Investor, and we hope everybody out there stays safe and stays healthy, and we wish you all a well moving into the future. Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast.